Begin after six taps. One, two, three, four, five, six.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to a podcast of a recording of three people talking about a couple of movies. I'm one of those people. My name is Lady P. And before you ask, no, there's no relation to Master P. And deigning us with his presence is our favorite piece of eye candy, Gabe Haggard.
Hello.
Gabe.
I'm not offended by that.
Okay. Gabe, put some clothes on. This is radio. That's really not necessary.
Wow. All my clothes are on. Falling.
Shh. Gabe and I are currently kowtowing before the bitter acid tongue film critic, Anne Marie Kelly.
I am going to bury your podcast.
Awesome. On today's show, we're going to tackle some big questions. What does it all mean? Does becoming a mega success necessarily mean making enormous personal sacrifices? Is it worth it? Must commerce always supersede art? And perhaps most importantly, who's got the cuter derriere, Brigitte Bardot or Edward Norton? Our topics are a pair of films about making film. First up is a movie about a man whose personal life is crumbling around him as he weighs his desire to make authentic art against the pressure to make base commercial entertainment. It's the 21st movie on the Sight and Sound Greatest of All Time list, Jean-Luc Godard's Contempt. We'll follow that up with a movie about a man whose personal life is crumbling around him as he weighs his desire to make authentic art against the pressure to make base commercial entertainment. It's Alejandro González Iñárritu's Birdman. You like how I got through that name?
Yeah.
I sped right through that.
I'm impressed.
We'll follow that up with some final notes of positivity. Are you guys ready to stick up for your personal vision despite the producers, the public, and the voices in your head telling you to do otherwise?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
All right, let's do it.
Carriage return.
First up, we're going to talk about Jean-Luc Godard's 1963 feature film, Le Mépris, also known as Contempt here in the States. Contempt tells the story of a novelist and playwright named Paul Javal, played by Michel Piccoli, hopefully I'm saying that right, who's been hired by a famous Hollywood movie producer, played by Mr. One-Arm Push-Up himself, Jack Palance. He's been hired by Jack Palance to spruce up a script for a film adaptation of Homer's Odyssey, which is currently in production and being directed by the one and only Fritz Lang, who plays himself in the film. Not the film within a film, but the film that Godard is directing. Make sense?
Yes.
Well, on the same page. Anyway, Paul, the writer, isn't sure if he should take the job. On the one hand, it would be a sizable payday. On the other, there are his artistic bona fides to consider. After all, movies help and all. And he's also a little hesitant to do the gig because it seems to require that he pimp out his wife, played by Brigitte Bardot, to the sleazy producer. Paul spends most of the movie grappling with the decision, weighing the cost of maintaining his credibility and his marriage against the cost of an apartment remodel. Before we jump in, I'd just like to remind the panelists of the third item on the FlixWise Declaration of Principles. It reads as follows. FlixWise will avoid using the word pretentious to describe any film on the Sight and Sound Greatest Films of All Time list, unless, of course, the film is really, really pretentious. I'm thinking it might be a temptation to describe this film as pretentious. However, let's avoid it if we can. And on that note, Gabe, what do you think of Contempt?
I found it very paradoxical. There are aspects of it that I really enjoyed and that I found very intriguing. And I think the whole journey that Godard is taking us on is really interesting in a lot of ways. But however, I don't like the way he executed a lot of what he did. So I don't like it overall, but there were a lot of interesting, you know, avenues and interesting takes that he used.
Anne Marie, how about you?
Yeah, it's watching Godard films tends to be a really esoteric experience. Like, it's not a story, or they aren't characters who I particularly emotionally feel for, even though there is a love story at the center of the movie. However, thinking about it, seeing the little bits and pieces that Godard does as a film lover making a movie about film, in a complete insider baseball moment, I did appreciate the arguments that he was making filmically, but it's, yeah, it's a bifurcated experience. On the one hand, watching it and intellectually appreciating it, but on the other hand, watching it and not particularly caring even a little bit about anything that the characters do or say.
Yeah. Couldn't have said it better myself. Well, where do you stand on other Godard films? Are there any that you do feel emotionally connected to?
The closest I'd say to feeling quote-unquote emotionally connected to is Breathless. Okay. And I think that partially has to do with the cast. Part of the problem that I had with Contempt is that Rich Bardot is very pretty to look at, but is kind of a black hole of, like, charisma.
I think so, too. And I feel like I'm going crazy because I'm reading all of these reviews and all these analyses of the film, and they all seem to claim that this is Bardot's best performance. And maybe compared to And God Created Women, this is her best work. But that being said, I see a pair of pursed lips and blonde hair. But you're right that there's no charisma on display. And so that it's puzzling for me that why she's getting these great reviews.
Some of that to me is a little confusing as to what the characters are supposed to be. Mm-hmm. It's hard to in a way pass judgment on whether or not they're doing it well.
Mm-hmm.
I really disliked many aspects of Paul's character, of the writer's character.
Mm-hmm.
And Jack Palance's character is, I think he may be doing a good job of sort of being the kind of sleazy, but almost really, I think, too much of a caricature of big Hollywood producer.
Yeah.
You know, so that may be going a little bit over the top.
I thought that was the most successful portion of the film, was the satire on movie making, mm-hmm. and the movie business. His Hollywood producer, I found him, while he was broad, I did find him really amusing. And it also, we should say that this is, some have said this is Godard's most self-reflexive film, which is a feat because most of Godard's films are pretty self-reflexive.
Like, oh boy.
But the production of this film basically mirrored the production that is depicted in the film.
Oh so, boy, that must have been a fun set to be on.
Exactly.
I think what we're all kind of talking about here is that Godard uses people like objects. Mm. I mean, this is when we talk about people being objectified in film. No, he's actually objectifying all of his characters. Bardot, most obviously, since she's put out on display frequently, against red, white, and blue backdrops, in case you weren't clear on the symbolism of the movie. But each of the characters is also more important for what they represent than who they are. Even Fritz Lang isn't really, you know, Fritz Lang director or Fritz Lang character so much as he is just symbol of past avant-garde cinema, Fritz Lang.
Right.
And I agree. I liked the producer character the most. Also, just because it reminded me so much of another insider baseball self-reflexive movie Palance has made before called The Big Knife, which was made in the 50s, where he was on the other side. He was the guy trying to figure out if he should sacrifice his art and sell out. Great noir. I highly suggest it. And I'm sure that's part of the reason why he ended up in Contempt. God knows Godard saw everything, so I'm sure he watched and went, him. I want him.
Right.
Yeah, and I've also read that this was, I believe, the sort of Godard's attempt, first and last attempt at a big budget film, and so he's kind of mocking it, but trying to do it himself.
Where did the budget go?
Right.
So, I mean, I think it went to like location and just the
CinemaScope.
Yeah. Exactly.
Actors.
And so it's an interesting, again, like the whole film just presents all these conundrums. It's like he is trying to do something while simultaneously mocking it. And I don't know how effective those two can be.
Yeah, and I thought a lot about 8 and a half while I was watching it, not only because they're both movies about artists struggling with, I think, a lot of insider movies about Hollywood have that same struggle at the heart of them, but also because the conflict in watching Eight and a Half is watching somebody deconstruct the movie that he's making while he's making it.
Right.
And it's really difficult to have it both ways. And they work to varying degrees of success. But yes, especially the movie within a movie in Contempt, most of what you see are the shots of statues with painted lips and painted eyes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You don't actually see much of the movie itself.
Right.
And so it's really difficult while they're all bickering over the quality of this movie to have any opinion on it whatsoever. And I think that's the point. I think it's supposed to be a blank canvas for the audience as well. But it does make it a little bit more difficult to side with any one specific character.
Right. I do think we're meant to side with Fritz Lang, the artist.
Yeah.
But I was unclear on where Paul's character falls on the artistic spectrum. Is he a sellout? Are we meant to believe that he is an artiste? At one point, his wife, Camille, comments that he is a pulp fiction writer. He writes detective stories. So, in a way, adapting The Odyssey is sort of more highfalutin, but it's still movies after all.
In a way, but it was the type of adaptation that the producer wanted him to do. The type of adaptation was, a high profile like action adventure type of thing is what he wanted.
Right.
So again, even in that, the writer was torn between like some of his dialogue with Fritz Lang, you know, about like, well, you know, what kind of a story we want to do. So he didn't, you know, it wasn't just like totally selling out by making a film. It was by making this film,
mm-hmm.
whether or not he was going to sell out.
Yeah. I wasn't sure how genuine his qualms about making a movie actually were, or how actually invested in high art the character was. I mean, I wasn't sure if he even bought into the inner conflict. The problem seemed to be the issue that his wife was having. And I don't know, do you think he had any real qualms?
This is where I have problems with French New Wave films, or at least Godard's French New Wave films, because all of his characters have this like layer of disaffectation that they just don't care about anything. They're having long arguments with each other where they both look like they're bored with the argument that they're having.
Yes.
And so I don't know either.
Yes.
I don't know how he felt about it, because he said one thing, but he was smoking a cigar in a bathtub while he was saying it and looking incredibly bored with the entire thing.
I don't get the feeling that Paul was much else other than kind of an idiot. Like, the whole time he's trying to figure out why his wife is upset.
Yeah.
And he all but, you know, serves her up on a platter to this producer.
Yeah.
And then
yep.
he spends the whole rest of the film, you know, kind of trying, what?
Right.
What?
Yeah.
You know, and I think, and then after the whole, you know, the big long half hour scene where he's arguing with his wife, I kind of got the feeling that, okay, maybe they kind of know where they stand now, at the very least. But then he just goes and does it again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, but then you might say that is really what what is happening in the film. The film is called Contempt, and it seems to be the story of how Camille's character comes to hold Paul in contempt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's interesting that the Paul character is very clearly a Godard surrogate, and yet it is probably the least flattering. The I'd say he's really the villain of the film. I mean, one could argue it's the Hollywood producer, but the wishy-washiness of Paul is so unappealing, and the idea that he would pimp out his wife is pretty revolting. So, I don't know. What does that say about Godard? I don't know.
I mean, I feel like if you're going to, it's a hallmark of autobiographical films about filmmaking and art. I mean, that's the Woody Allen has the Woody Allen surrogate and all that jazz. Bob Fosse has the Bob Fosse surrogate.
Yeah.
Even in, The Bad and the Beautiful, there's the Val Lewton surrogate. So I think that's like a necessary piece of it. And they're almost always the, if not outright villain, at least the most complex and maybe unlikable character.
Yeah.
But yeah, Godard clearly has some contempt for himself that he was working through during that picture.
Yeah. And at the time of the production, he was having marital issues. A lot of what you see on screen was very likely what happened in his real life. So it's really a movie about turning the lens on himself. If you'll forgive the film.
Yeah, he was mostly turning it on Brigitte Bardot's rear.
And that, yes.
All the way from the very opening scene, I felt like I kind of realized that Godard was trying to make a point about the objectification of women in film. Where I kind of have trouble with that is he was making that point by objectifying women in film.
Sure, mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, you have a way to have your cake and eat it too, mm-hmm. kind of thing, you know?
Yeah, and so that I found to be somewhat troubling.
Yeah.
Like, I like the point that he was making, that it's bad to objectify women in film.
But show you how it's
exactly,
done.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, no, objectifying women, you know, is not what we want to do.
Right. I think he was actually Godard was forced by his producers to put in that scene. They insisted on having naked Brigitte Bardot, and he's like, well, I'm going to give you naked Brigitte Bardot.
and that was really interesting that I read something about yeah. that. It said that, and that the way he shot it, he shot it in a very sort of stilted, not necessarily all that erotic a way.
Right. She mm-hmm. looks just, like one of the statues, kind of.
Right. Yeah, it was just very, very straightforward. And right in that scene, I almost thought you could kind of explain the whole film because, you know, they go like travel up her entire body and they're speaking of completely external physical things.
Mm-hmm. How do you like my shoulder?
Yeah.
Yeah. And then he says, I love you. And so there's the I thought they were juxtaposing the two things, like erotic, like physical exploitation
mm-hmm.
and then love. Mm-hmm. What real love is. And so I think like that was kind of the problem in the whole movie that plays out in the whole movie is he doesn't love his wife.
Mm-mm.
He, you know, he objectifies her.
Right.
And like, hey, well, he's going to objectify her to try to get a paycheck and Yeesh. To try to do this and try to do that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I thought like that whole scene, although they did like tack it on at the end because the producers wanted him to, it did kind of set the tone for the problem with the whole film.
Right. I should say, time-wise, they tacked it on at the end. It actually happens at the beginning of the
yes.
film.
Yes.
And I agree. That was actually the scene that, because it did feel very much like the thesis for the entire movie, that was the scene that I liked watching the most. Also because I'm Godard and I'm shooting it in color, so let's put in color filters over the light because we can. And it's one of those things that watching Godard movies is fun just for watching that new wavy, we know what the rules are and we're just going to break them because we can
right.
type of thing.
Right.
He did a lot in the editing in Breathless. He does it constantly. He does it now. He released a 3D film this year.
Yeah.
But watching that was great because Douglas Sirk did it in All That Heaven Allows, playing with colored film to colored light to explain characters' emotional states. It happens in All That Jazz, but in both of those movies, there's a diegetic reason for the colored light to be showing up. Godard doesn't need reasons for the thing, for diegetic specific location reasons for anything to happen in any of his films. So right. it starts out red, then it's white, then it's blue. You know why? Just 'cause.
Right. Right, yeah. I mean, his whole thing. Exactly, because he can. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's so hard to gauge how genuine he is. So much of the time, I just feel like he's taking a piss. Like,
that's one way of putting it.
Are you serious? I always feel like suckered into the movies sometimes because I'm like, how seriously should I take this? Or because you're just having a ball, aren't you? Which like there's a like sort of punk rock ethos to behind that, which I can appreciate. But when you have a movie about marital discord, you sort of want to know that it's safe to emotionally invest a little bit. But if you don't, it sounds like both of you felt completely emotionally disconnected anyway. So, mm-hmm. yeah. So, Godard, as you mentioned, Anne-Marie, was a huge film snob, film guy. And he, in addition to just filling the screen with pretty bored people. He also packed in a lot of movie references, including several Howard Hawks references.
Pretty bored people. Yeah. Sorry. Okay, you guys. It's just great.
Paul suggests going to see Rio Bravo. They stand behind an Atari poster. Do you see any direct Hawks influence?
This is one of those things about the New Wave that always kind of fascinates me, is that there was this obsession with Howard Hawks as an auteur director, and he's never one, like, now I don't think of him that way, only because, like Billy Wilder, he did so many genres, and it's not like, you know, Ford, who made pretty much one or two types of movie and made them really well. It's not like Hitchcock, who made one type of movie and made it well. Our vision of, or our idea of auteur now tends to be at least, if not specifically genre associated, then at least specific vision associated. And Howard Hawks wasn't one of those guys. He made screwball comedies. He made westerns. He did all of this stuff. And so I couldn't find a specific moment in the movie where I was like, yes, that is a Howard Hawks type scene. Because all of them are Howard Hawks type scenes. And that's one of the brilliant things about Howard Hawks. But it also could just be that I'm not savvy enough to pick up on them. And Godard is having a laugh behind my back.
Probably. But I... But I think Rio, you're right. It's hard to pinpoint a specific Hawksian style, because I just think of like rapid fire dialogue. But even like Rio Bravo, there isn't that much rapid fire there, aside from the stuff with Angie Dickinson. Mm-hmm. But it did seem kind of Rio Bravo esque in its like pacing. It seemed like we're cool to hang out here for a while, like they do in Rio Bravo. You know,
that's a good point. Yeah, I didn't think about that.
And the style, you know, he obviously references Some Came Running, which is Vincent Minnelli, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, and like I said, he did the Douglas Sirkian playing with colored light bit, and he had a ball with messing with diegetic sound. I like the word diegetic, but it also
That's
works.
It's a good word.
Messing with non-diegetic sound. And so, yeah, he was... There's no one... There are very few moments where I was like, yes, that is one specific director that he is referencing, because he's a man who is steeped in the language of film and therefore messing with it as much as possible.
Okay. So I find it sometimes irritating when a filmmaker will cite specific works that he or she thinks are cool. You know how like Woody Allen will constantly cite Bergman or whatever, like, you should really like Bergman, guys.
That's
I didn't feel like Godard was doing that in this case.
Yeah, I didn't have a problem with it. I don't know. I guess if, for those of you in film school, a really fun side project would be to start a new wave drinking game where you just watch Godard films and drink every time you catch a movie reference.
But that would be
I didn't say shots, just a drink. Oh, God, no, don't die. Just a drink.
Just a sip.
Just a sip.
Okay.
Yeah, I didn't have a specific problem with it. I thought it worked within the context just because it was a movie about movies. I did like how they used Cinecittà as the location for a lot of the movie stuff, especially because he was right at the time. It was dying. And because I just watched a bunch of Sophia Loren movies, so I was like, yay, Italian cinema gets a shout out before it dies.
So you didn't think it was pandering to film buffs? It wasn't like spot the reference here?
No, because it comes from probably the only earnest place that Godard has, which is a true and passionate love of film.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's not putting it in as a look how smart I am type of reference. He's putting it in, or at least from the position I was coming from, was that he was putting it in because there was something about that movie that informed what he was doing or what he loved about this particular scene. And, you know, it was just a quick shout out thing. It wasn't like throwing in a reference to, this is just a random one. It wasn't like, let's say, remaking all of Psycho just because you like the movie Psycho.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was coming from a really honest place.
Okay.
That was my take on it. And it's, I don't know, that's it. That's my take on it.
Okay, time for the final question.
Uh-oh.
Do you think Contempt is worthy of the 21st spot on the Sight and Sound Critics poll? Gabe.
I don't think so. I think I would put it far lower.
Fair enough. Anne-Marie?
I think these kind of self-referential films about films end up really high on best of lists and in, let's be honest, Academy appreciations, the artist says what, because they, because Hollywood and just filmmakers in general love movies about movies.
That's true.
And I think that bumps it much higher than maybe it would have been if the subject had been, I don't know, basket weaving. That's slightly tongue-in-cheek, but I think it probably, yeah, I think it's, some of its laurels are maybe a little bit less deserved.
Well, I mean, I think you're right. I think on a audience poll,
mm-hmm.
it's probably not going to be nearly as high.
Mm-hmm.
But on, you know, a critics poll or an insider's insider poll, these types of films are going to be much higher because they're like, oh, that's us. Oh, watch this one, guys. That's us.
Pretty much. Yeah, I'm in agreement with both of you. I think 21 is way too high, especially since we've already had a Godard film on the list.
Well, okay,
and we have yet to hear from François Truffaut, which.
And here's another thing that I think you're right about that. And since we have Breathless, I feel like Breathless is representative enough of Godard that we don't need another film. At least in such close proximity.
Mm-hmm.
This was just, in many ways, this was just sort of an overblown, much higher budget, much bigger scale Godard film. And I don't think the bigger budgets necessarily lend themselves to what Godard has to say. I'm not claiming to know what Godard has to say exactly, but the half-hour-long relationship scene between a man and a woman. He did that and very well in Breathless, in a much more pared-down, much more bare-bones, black-and-white, you know, all in one bed. They go to the bathroom for a little while, you know, mm-hmm. but in a much more intimate setting. And it works.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that scene. Whereas this one kind of really just steps it up a notch, but I don't feel like we got anything bigger or better or more. And so I don't see that this, especially in light of the fact that Breathless is on the list, I don't think we need this one.
Fair enough. All right. Well, the listeners can tell us what they think about Contempt and whether how wrong we are. Goodbye to Language, Godard's most recent film, will hopefully be coming to a theater near you. That is, if you live in a big city. I believe there is going to be some kind of rollout later in early 2015. That's what I hear. And we are going to release this podcast on Jean-Luc Godard's birthday. So
it's Jean-Luc Godard's birthday.
It's December 3rd.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Or close to it. So happy birthday, Jean-Luc.
Happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
Okay.
I'm sure he's going to hear this.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. And just when you thought the navel gazing was over, we're back with another movie about a dude who's staring into an infinity mirror. It's Alejandro González Iñárritu's Birdman, or The Unexpected Virtue of Ignorance, a film that I think is even more self-referential and meta than Contempt, and that is no easy feat. Birdman is about a washed-up actor named Regan Thompson, who's attempting to resurrect his career by writing, directing, and starring in a Broadway adaptation of a Raymond Carver story. Before his playwriting days, Riggins was best known for playing a superhero named, you guessed it, Birdman. And of course, Regan is played by Michael Keaton. You get it? Because he played Batman.
Because he played Batman.
Yeah, like a million years ago, yeah.
You see what they did there?
Yeah.
It's clever.
The film follows Regan as he tries to make amends for both his personal and professional shortcomings, balance public expectations with his own creative impulses, deal with the fragile ego of his actors, make sure his wig is on straight, all while trying to keep his secret superpowers under wraps.
That was the best wig ever, because it didn't even give him a full head of hair.
Nope.
But it was like, what was the point of this wig? You didn't even realize the first time he goes to take it off. It's just like a little more hair.
And slightly blonder.
Yeah.
All right. Anne-Marie, did you like Birdman?
I did like it. I have seen it twice. I will probably end up seeing it again. First of all, I really like movies about theater. I really like movies that do self-referential casting. I really like movies that are ambitious enough to try to shoot everything, or at least make it look like they've shot everything in one take. So basically what I'm saying is this is entirely in my wheelhouse.
Okay.
Oh, I also really like movies with unconventional scores. So yes, it's like they made an entire movie just for me.
That was nice of him.
I know, it really was. So I'm coming from a highly biased standpoint, is what I'm going to say right
okay.
now.
Okay. Okay. Well, Gabe?
No, I didn't really like it.
Okay.
I found the drums. It was too much. It was too much.
So exactly what Anne-Marie liked about it, you hated about
that's
it?
That's kind of what it sounds like. Yeah. That's kind of what it sounds like. I thought there were a variety of performances in it that were really, really good. And like at the end, I was like, okay. When I walked out, I was like, okay, I didn't like that. It's like, well, then why did I sit there like engaged the whole time? And I was like, oh yeah, because there were some like really cool things happening.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was very, very engaging.
Mm-hmm.
The gimmick I felt of it all being in one shot was kind of cool, but it kind of got a little old because I am a big fan of gimmicks and things that lend themselves towards a central narrative or a central theme the director is trying to convey to you. And I didn't see the way that the one shot kind of helped move the narrative along. And I also didn't like the ending. I thought that...
Hang on.
Okay.
Spoilers.
Do we not want to?
What do you guys think? Should we spoil the movie?
Well, I mean,
at this point, it's been out a while. By the time this gets released, it will have been out for a while. So let's just give
I'm a big fan of spoilers, I gotta be honest.
Well, in that case, spoilers, guys!
What I thought was the ending of the film was sort of it doesn't matter. That really aggravates me because I like, artsy films. I like, artists that want to push the boundaries and do all sorts of things. But what I like even more than that is artists that want to say something. Mm-hmm. And so I'm like, just say something so then we can fight about it.
Before we get too far ahead of ourselves.
Right. What did you think of it?
I'm going to split the difference and say I enjoyed watching it while I was watching it. I thought it was a little long, and I could see, as I was watching it, I could see parts that needed to get cut. Like, what is this doing in this movie?
Mm.
And at the same time, I totally understood why he didn't want to cut those parts. For instance, I think everything with Ed Norton and Emma Stone could have gotten cut. Didn't need that whole side plot. That would have saved us 20 minutes or so.
Well, and I almost thought that it may have been a point or a subplot that I didn't myself fully understand. Because when Ed Norton comes out onto the roof, I think it's like the second time, and Emma Stone is out there, and he gives her that speech about how, but your dad is really right. You're amazing. You know, it felt so incongruous to me. But then I realized, wait a minute, I think he is just trying to, seduce her.
Well, I think, okay, so I know that I've unequivocally come out and said that I love this movie, and I stand by that. The conflict that I had while watching it was that for up until about the time, I'm not even going to say spoilers, except I'm going to, spoilers. Up until the time where Regan completely loses his mind, it really is mostly a character study. Like, you get these little vignettes between two or more people, usually two people, where they'll just sit and they'll talk about something, how they're feeling, what reasons they have for being in the play, what reasons they have for being in life, what reasons they have for spitting on the fat guy on the street. Just it's these little series of vignettes up until I'd call it the first third act, which is when Regan completely goes bonkers.
Mm-hmm.
At which point, it really just becomes about Regan. And the difficulty with that is that all of those extra characters, the great scenes with Naomi Watts, the great scene, the little bits of Zach Galifianakis we got, which I wish we got more of him. Yeah. The bits with his wife, just all of that fell away. The bits with Emma Stone just fell away. And it really just became about one man losing his mind. Right. And so that ended up being the difficulty, is that then looking back, you're like, well, why do we have all of these little character vignettes if they're not actually the important, you know, the important, I don't know what you'd call thesis or conclusion of this movie.
Right.
Especially when you get into kind of the second, third act when he wakes up in the hospital and really you only see Emma Stone for, it more or less ends on Emma Stone, but none of the other characters end up mattering.
Right.
Yeah, and I also thought, because... spoilers. I also thought, basically, he has his way, he gets his ending twice. He shoots himself in the face, and I thought it would have been great if it just ended there. Like, if he shoots himself in the face, and that's it. Like,
yeah.
Oops. But I guess because he's the point of view character, they kind of kept going for a little bit, and then he kills himself again, basically. And that was... I'm not saying spoilers. And that part bothers me, I guess. It just because it felt like it was going towards a specific conclusion, which is him pulling a Molière and dying on stage. Molière didn't kill himself; he just had a heart attack on stage. But sacrificing himself for his art and dying, and nope, then he woke up in the hospital. And just by virtue of him being the point of view character, I guess it had to linger. But it felt like cheating and getting the ending, getting hit to do an ending twice.
Right. Well, that's the thing. And again, this was a film that was kind of a send up of Hollywood in many respects.
Mm-hmm.
But I almost think, not that this would have been a type of film that I would have enjoyed, but I almost feel like he's sticking it to Hollywood, but he stopped short of actually killing the guy on stage.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't think the Hollywood machine would have reacted well to that at all.
Really?
I don't think they would have liked that. And I almost think the second ending, you know, he had to put on in a way just to sort of pacify. I mean, just suggesting that as a reason for why there are, you know, kind of two endings.
Mm-hmm.
Reason to sort of why that had to happen, because that would have been a very, very dark ending. You know, like, look, you know, Christian Bale, look, so-and-so, like, this is what's going to happen to you, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah, maybe.
I don't think Bale's in any way concerned about that. I think that would be more of an RDJ thing. But...
I don't know. It seemed like they kept that, they tacked on that second ending just so they could keep it seemed that they wanted to suggest that some of the magical realist elements were, in fact, real. That Riggins may very well be an actual superhero.
It did give us the visual of Birdman on the toilet, which I thought was so hilarious. But, well, it did give it more of an ambiguous, is he going nuts or are the magical realism moments happening? Which, or is Emma Stone just going insane, and when she looks up, she's just kind of continuing the trend of mental illness in the family?
Could be.
In the using the theater to send up Hollywood, and having the acerbic critic and the troubled star and the young ingenue, it felt very All About Eve-y to me.
Without, I hadn't considered it.
Without the...
Minus the cattiness.
Minus the cattiness, minus the lesbian subtext, minus is that face about the lesbian subtext?
Maybe a
little. Oh, please. Anne Baxter is totally gay in that movie, and I will argue that point to the death. That is not the point I'm making.
I won't fight you.
In the having a lot of characters constantly discussing what the definition of stardom is and what the definition of theater is. I mean, you basically have the acerbic critic who is Addison DeWitt 2.0. Yeah. With the exception that honestly, if you pick up the New York Times, nobody ever destroys a play on stage just because a famous actor or actress is in it.
Right.
Like, 9 times out of 10, instead, they'll just hand them a Tony.
Right.
Scarlett Johansson was absolutely great and probably deserved that Tony, but let's be real. Like, she got a 5-minute-long acceptance speech for a supporting actress Tony because she's Scarlett Johansson. Like, that was a really unbelievable scene. It was fun to watch the critic tear into him and certainly fit in with this kind of self-loathing cycle that he was on, but it wasn't really believable that the Ben Brantley type would say or do that.
Yeah, I hated that scene. I thought it was just a total misrepresentation of what film critics do. And since this is such a meta film, it's clearly meant to basically be a giant middle finger to anyone who's ever criticized an Iñárritu film. And there are plenty of people who have, including myself. I speak as an amateur. I'm not a film critic. But I felt very defensive for every film critic out there because I do think film critics serve an important role. I think critics in general serve a very important role. And it's so indulgent, I think, to say, I'm the artist, I can do what I want, and everyone else who has anything negative to say about my work is just a shrew, a mean, vile shrew. And the reason that people, I think that artists sometimes have a very basic misunderstanding of what criticism is. It's like, critics don't hate what they're talking about, they love what they're talking about. And their job is not to tear down, it is to celebrate great work and to lament when work falls short of greatness.
But you didn't think that he kind of gets his punches back? And, like, I don't know, is it in the same scene? Then he just goes off on his own spiel at her about what a horrible person she is.
Well, I mean, that's the whole point. I think the audience is meant, we the audience are meant to hate the critic.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, she's the closest thing to an absolute villain that the film has.
I mean, she is basically, if she had a mustache, she would absolutely be twirling it.
I mean, if I had a mustache, right. I'd be absolutely twirling it.
True. Basically, Anne-Marie and I are just mad that we can't grow mustaches.
And twirl them. No, I'm sorry, I completely derailed your point with that. But yeah, the film does not have anything particularly nice to say about Riggins' play either. I mean, it is one of the many hanging issues that Iñárritu has is whether this film is, or excuse me, whether the play is any good or whether it is this like shallow bid for legitimacy that is actually just crap.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's a big thing. And that's why I didn't as much single out specifically the critic. Like, what he's doing might very well be a piece of junk.
Sure, yeah, but I still think that her single-minded intent, she has a vendetta against him.
She does, and she's going to dismiss it without even actually seeing it. That's true. But let's not forget that there is a dream sequence with reindeer in this movie. In this play.
That's the thing.
That was one of my favorite lines in the entire show.
I don't remember that in the novel.
Because I do think that at least the possibility is there that he doesn't deserve anything else.
Well, mm-hmm. Sure, yeah.
And it does. The play does have a lot of, like, the bits of the play that you see, and you see more of the play tying it in than you do of the movie in Contempt. You see more of the play within the movie than you see of the movie within the movie in Contempt. But it's full of these really awful, like, theater cliches, like the guy who monologues and then suddenly turns to the audience and a spotlight hits him while he monologues on the meaning of love. And I was saying this before, this is my favorite line in the entire movie when the supporting actress comes in and says, you know, when I imagined my Broadway debut, I didn't see the reindeer. Nice touch. Because it is just such a ridiculously over the top. Like, yes, this is the kind of self-indulgent, weird, striving for legitimacy type of thing that a self-involved, narcissistic actor, playwright, director, producer would put on in order to prove himself to 900 white guys in the audience who are mostly worrying about their own cheesecake. And really that this bid for... And this is one part that I wish they'd played up more. His bid for legitimacy or his bid for, you know, some kind of power that he would seem to feel comes from legitimacy, because his problem seems to be that he's not famous in the way that he wants to be. Like, he obviously really wants fame and wants attention, but he's always looking for the right kind of attention, which seems to change by scene what kind of attention he wants. But there's that entire scene where he ends up a YouTube sensation And Emma Stone has this one-off line of, you see this is real power, because he's getting like millions of hits, versus 900 white guys in a theater who are mostly thinking about what they're going to eat at Sardi's after the play is over. And so it's this like little thing that gets thrown in and almost forgotten, but it is a kind of important part, I think, of the changing definition of celebrity that I wish they had touched on a little bit more, because we have three actors in this movie who have been movie stars in large franchises, yeah. Superhero franchises, yeah. No less, who are internet celebrities because of those roles. And so
Right. It's
something that I think could have been played up a little bit more, but I was happy to see it in there.
Yeah, I don't know. That whole thing felt very didactic. Like
The whole movie is didactic.
The whole movie is didactic. But that scene in particular, like, we're going to tell it. Let me explain Twitter to you.
Well, yeah. For people like my mother who are on, who keep asking me how to use the Twitter page, it might be necessary.
Okay, and my favorite part of the whole movie, I think, is Emma Stone's tattoo on her shoulder.
What is it? I don't remember.
It's really cool. It's like a feather, mm-hmm. that then like turns into like three or four birds.
Mm. I didn't notice that.
Oh man, watch the whole movie again just to see that.
I also have to say that the first time I saw this movie, I saw it at a critics screening, and there is nothing more awkward than walking out of a movie that lambasts critics, surrounded by critics who are all like, "Well, that was very interesting, the way that she talked about us." And tying it in again, like Contempt, I think these characters are mostly meant to be representative of specific things. Like Emma Stone is the millennial. You've got the, you know, washed up actor. But part of what's so great about the performances, and to a certain extent about the writing, is that they turn them into humans as well. I mean, you've got this fantastic scene that doesn't need to exist between the two supporting actresses, Naomi Watts and the other actress.
What was that doing in there?
Because we can. And why don't we break the Bechdel test while we're at it?
Like, I guess so. Was that a reference to Mulholland Drive or something?
No, I don't think so. I think you've just got two people who really, really want attention. This is a movie about people who want attention.
Yeah.
And you've got two people who are really looking for validation and only find at each other. And I don't know, I guess it looks good in the trailer too.
That's what I was thinking, that almost in a way it was Iñárritu doing exactly what he was lambasting all these different characters for doing, just putting something in, like you said, just kind of because.
Yeah, this, you know, movie, so. Someone needs to explain to Alejandro about killing his darlings, because while I did like that scene, it just felt like something out of a completely different movie. All right.
Yep.
I walked out of the movie feeling dazzled, but at the same time feeling like I could totally see what could have gone to make this movie much better.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right. Well, one more question. Seeing as how we talked about Godard earlier in the program, did we notice any formal or thematic parallels between Birdman and Contempt?
I think we already talked about that a little bit. Yeah, yeah. About it being about the nature of why we make what we make.
Yes.
And the ever disintegrating relationships of art. Are there happily married artists? The movies make it seem
doesn't
otherwise.
Doesn't bode well for art. I know.
Sophia Loren was married to one guy for her entire life.
Yeah.
Meryl Streep's been happily married for a while. Cate Blanchett has been happily married.
To other non-famous, famous dudes.
That's the thing. You don't hear about it too much because they're like, if it ain't broke, you know, yeah. No one wants to talk about it.
Or look at it, apparently.
Yeah.
That too. in Richard Brody's review in The New Yorker, he highlights the title sequence and directly compares it to Godard films, and basically gives Iñárritu more fodder for his next portrayal of a critic, because he just ripped the thing apart.
I have to say, despite the fact that the main character shoots himself in the face and then jumps out a window, this is the happiest Iñárritu movie.
I know. Like, there were actual jokes in it.
Only one person dies, and it's pretty funny.
Yeah.
I'm not convinced he died.
Only one person shoots his face off. Yeah. And yeah, I'm not either. I think this meant to be specifically ambiguous.
Yeah.
But
which is disappointing to me. But I mean, because
you don't like ambiguity.
No, I don't enjoy it. No. But, like, because it's in a scene, you know, when he finally, when they walk in and you finally see that Riggins is just physically destroying his dressing room, mm-hmm. you know, because all the time before that, you see him, like, moving things with the Force.
I like that poster. Sorry, I really, it's a great moment.
And then, they finally catch him in the act and you realize that he's actually just, you know, and I know that that's done purposely. So mm-hmm. then you go, oh, okay, he really is just crazy. And then that sets up even more appropriately the ending to be like, what happened? Mm. You know?
Well, like, it's like when he's flying through the streets of New York and then he runs inside and the taxi driver falls and I'm like, hey, you didn't pay me.
Yeah.
It is nice to see Michael Keaton come back and get really
Indeed.
Involved again.
Yeah. Do we want to talk about our favorite performances in the movie? Do we have one?
I think Zach Galifianakis could have been if he had been in it more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's good.
I felt like he didn't quite get his hooks all the way in me. Like, I really enjoyed his performance, but then I felt like I couldn't quite peg it to then really be able to mm-hmm. settle in and enjoy it. I wasn't quite sure where he was coming from, where he was going. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. I really enjoyed Emma Stone's performance, partially just because I was a fan back. Like, do you remember when Easy A was made and everybody was talking about how it was going to be Emma Stone is like the next it thing, the next big hot thing?
Right.
And then, like, nothing. She did The Help and everybody gave her crap for The Help, kind of rightfully so. And then she ended up being the love interest in a bunch of blockbusters. So it's really nice to see her, like, come back and start maybe trying to fulfill that potential from a few years ago. So I was very, very happy to see that. And also to watch Edward Norton play Edward Norton, gigantic method actor douchebag.
Yeah.
That was pretty good too.
He was great. I'd have to say he's probably my favorite performance. Really digging in, you know, into that Ed Norton.
Yeah.
You know?
I just wonder how much of that is just Edward Norton being Edward Norton, troubled method actor.
Yeah. Do your thing, Ed.
Yeah.
All right. On that note.
Carriage. Return.
Gabe, I've got great news for you.
Yes.
You have an opportunity to make up for all the bad vibes you put into the universe. Because it's time.
I have my clothes on. I do have my clothes on. I want them to realize that.
All right, well, it's time once again for our fun. That is not a final note of positivity. That's not going to do it.
Gabe's got clothes on. Final note of positivity.
I'm pretty positive about that.
It's time once again for our final notes of positivity. Gabe, what's one piece of culture, pop or otherwise, that you've been digging lately?
It is an exhibit that's currently at the Getty Museum.
Okay.
So for you all around the country and the world, this isn't really going to help you out very much. But it is called Fantastic Rubens, and it's a series of tapestries done by Ruben, I think in the 17th century, that he made to adorn a chapel in Spain. And they're really, really impressive, just in like their scope. They're probably about like 15 by 15, maybe, 15 feet by 15 feet. And they're just very, very spectacular.
All right. I don't usually think of Rubens in tapestry. That's interesting.
Yeah. And he made them off of a series of paintings.
Okay.
So he did the paintings, which are much, much smaller than the tapestries.
Mm.
But yeah, it was really cool.
Yeah, it sounds cool. Emery, how about you?
Most of this year has been, for me, devoted to doing a lot of research. So I haven't had a lot of time for fun reading. But as that has dwindled, I've been able to take up the fun reading again, and I realized that this year was a really good year for female authors. And so I've been reading up a storm, like back in February, I think, Rachel Schuchert, who is a playwright and currently writing for the Red Band Society, the TV series, and did the most amazing recaps on any TV show ever when she was covering Smash.
Okay.
She released her second young adult novel based in classic Hollywood called Love Me, I think. Then Roxane Gay released Bad Feminist, which was awesome. And another book about classic Hollywood's coming out soon called Scandals of Classic Hollywood, and Helen Peterson, who wrote for The Hairpin and is currently writing for BuzzFeed, actually. She does fantastic articles on the nature of celebrity now, the nature of celebrity then, just witty, fun, amazing stuff. She has a doctorate in celebrity gossip, which is pretty awesome.
I didn't know you could get that.
She made it up and she did it.
Awesome.
And then Mallory Ortberg of The Toast, which is a humor site, just released or just published Texts from Jane Eyre, which is a series of texts from various historic and fictional characters. Everybody from Jane Eyre to like Zelda Fitzgerald, and they're all really funny and possibly too accurate, and just, yeah, they're, I highly suggest all of those books. Mom, if you're listening to this, I need some more things on my wish list.
Well, I guess this is going to just be the final note of positivity about Los Angeles, because I also have a museum exhibit. I apologize to any listeners who aren't in LA and have no plans to come here. But if by chance you find yourself in our fair city, specifically the Miracle Mile area, the Los Angeles County Museum of Art has an exhibition called Haunted Screens, German Cinema in the 1920s. And it's going to run until April 26, 2015. And it's a display of the artwork and movie posters from the Expressionist era of German movie making. And it features artwork and posters of works by Fritz Lang.
Yay!
See what I did there?
I did see that.
Awesome. We talked about him earlier.
That's what you call one of them there, tie-ins.
Yep. But if you aren't in LA, first of all, I'm sorry. second of all, you can go ahead and just watch Metropolis or M or any of other of Lang's other great works. So there you go. Mm-hmm. And that's the way we frame it, Flixwise, that is. Have any thoughts on Birdman or Contempt that you'd care to share? Come lay them on us in the comments section on our website, flixwise.com. You can also leave us a message on Facebook at facebook.com/flixwise. You can find me on Twitter. The handle is @flixwise. And if you'd be so kind, please rate us and leave us a decent review on iTunes. On our next show, we're headed back in time a few centuries. It's the 24th greatest movie of all time, Akira Kurosawa's Rashomon. Until then, Anne-Marie, thanks for coming on the show.
Always a pleasure.
Gabe.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, time to end the show now. So, what do you guys think? Ed or Brigitte?
Oh.
I gotta go with Ed, right? That was a cute tush. Ha ha ha!